Welcome back to the Artist Care and Feeding podcast. I am Kathleen Falsani here with my co-host, Caitlin Barrett.
Hey, everyone.
And our international man of mystery, producer Mark. Moomin Shantz. Our guest today is one of my favorite human beings on the planet, and that is not an overstatement. Terry Hemmert is a national treasure. She has been broadcasting on WXRT FM radio in Chicago for 47 years and is still doing her weekend Breakfast with the Beatles show, even though she technically retired last year. She is a musicologist and has taught decades worth of students about the history of rock and soul at Chicago's Columbia College, and she is a member of the Radio Hall of Fame. And I like to think of her best as Aunt Terry. She is so very precious to me and is one of the most interesting people I know. Terry, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here.
Yay! It's nice to see your face. Audience, you can't see your face, but we can see it. And it's glorious to behold. It's been way too long since I've seen
it. And her background is pretty stellar also.
Yes, the banditos. We might have to share that with you. We'll grab a little screen grab of that.
Okay.
Of the masked Beatles behind her.
Well, anyway. I wear that to remind my students when we Zoom to keep their masks on. If the Beatles can wear the mask, so can
That's
my
right.
students. Yeah.
That's right.
There we go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Wisdom.
So we start the show with the same question every time, and it's an appropriately and sometimes maddening, depending on who you are, vague question. It's designed to be that way. So I don't think you'll have any trouble with any of these. How, artistically speaking, if I can get the question right, how mm-hmm. would you describe yourself?
Artistically speaking, I'm a disc jockey. I'm not disc jockeys.
No pressure at all.
Disc jockeys are just disc jockeys. I mean, artistically,
are they?
I'm a teacher too, yes. and actually, I've always seen my work on the radio sort of like a teaching thing too.
Yeah,
and like any teacher worth their salt, it's also a learning curve for me because I'm always learning. And so I picked a good career for that because it's always been challenging. It's always changing and staying the same all at the same time. It's looking back. It's looking to the future. And then I teach at Columbia College too and have taught at some inner city schools. I used to go into the Archdiocese of Chicago. They had these parochial schools in the inner city of Chicago, and I go in with a bag of VHS tapes and say, okay, now I'm going to talk to you about the roots of rap. And they'd look at me, and I was probably 30 then. They probably thought, what's an old white lady doing here? And by the end of it, we were bonding and we were talking, and so I didn't say rap is crap. I said, here's where it came from. You should know your history, make you smarter. And this is really great history. And they loved it. But I always found that radio gave me a chance to perform. So I guess that's artistic, to communicate and to challenge myself to think of different ways of doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, when I turn off the mic and leave the studio, that's when all the other stuff begins. The mic puts me in the position where I have some influence and some contact and get to meet people like you. You've been on my show. I don't know if that answers your question, but
it sure does.
Okay.
Yeah.
It seems like you
also connect too. That's one of your artistic superpowers.
I like doing that.
Absolutely.
I have a real deep respect for my audience, for my students, and my students will tell you, I just love them. I feed them. I encourage them. I stay in touch with them for decades. I just got a picture of somebody's firstborn he sent me the other day, and that just warms my heart. But even with radio listeners, and it's kind of weird because basically radio's weird because you're sitting in the room talking by yourself. That's kind of weird.
And you can't see your audience.
I have no idea who's listening. At 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, half of them were overdosing. The other half were contemplating suicide and then calling me and asking me to play a song for them to die to. I mean, I ended up going through a volunteer program where I learned how to deal with crisis phones. Stuff. I even volunteered and worked there once a week for a couple of years. And because I was getting so many crisis calls on the radio station, because who do you call 3 o'clock in the morning when you want to kill
your friendly neighborhood DJ?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Someone you know is awake. you know?
Yes. Yeah. And also anonymous. I don't know that I'll never see them. Mm. So they have that. That's an advantage.
That sounds
horrifying. And they know.
It was horrifying.
And trust you.
Yes. Yes.
Like,
it was horrifying.
I feel like I know a lot of DJs because I've listened to them for years.
I still the same way when I meet a disc jockey. I get like a 14-year-old girl again.
So I guess if you're in crisis, the only people you can trust are the people that you listen to constantly who just gave you their phone number on air.
Right.
So.
And I've had some really interesting interactions and some happy endings. I don't know about the ones that aren't happy because they aren't around to tell me. But there's that. But no, I'm glad I went through the training because it didn't tell me how to take care of it. It just broadened my understanding about what they were going through. And sometimes I'd play the tough love call. Sometimes I'd play the, please don't die, you know, but you had to, it's like trusting your instinct and knowledge. But it was a challenge.
That must have been a long time ago because you haven't done an overnight shift in
quite a
while.
Not for a long time.
Most of the time that I was in Chicago, 20 odd years, you were the mid morning person.
Yeah, people aren't offing themselves then. They have to get to work and they have to get through the day. And then at 3 o'clock in the morning, then they're going, is that all there is? Yeah.
So was that towards the beginning of your radio career?
Oh, yeah.
You must have been quite young. Also,
I was very young.
Which makes it even more difficult.
I was in my early 20s. Yeah. Yeah, it was in my early 20s. And but it really showed me how intimate radio can be. And to me, it's a privilege to be in people's lives like that. And like to be there the morning after John Lennon was murdered, you know, and that was the hardest show I ever did. To come into work while 9/11's in progress.
That's what
and
I
have it unfold.
I've told you that.
You know? Yeah.
Right. I'll get very choked up talking about, I'll just tell the story.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm in the shower the morning that it happens. We had NPR on, but we never turned the TV on in the morning, and the phone rang and Maury answered it. And it was the guy, the morning assignment editor. And Roger wants to talk to you. I was like, oh boy, what did the Cardinal do? That's what I'm thinking.
Oh, no.
Covered religion, you know?
Yeah.
And he said, how soon can you get down here? And I was like, I looked at the time. I was like, I should be in by 10. He goes, turn on your television. And I turned it on, saw it was happening. And I was like, okay, I'll be there as soon as I can. And I got in the car 10 minutes later, turned on the radio to XRT, which is what it was always on, and started trying to figure out the best way to drive into town. I lived on the west side of Chicago. So you could go down the expressway, you could go through the west side. And just because we didn't know if they were going to be closing highways and what was going on, I drove through the west side down Lake Street into listening to you and looking at the sky and going, please, God, don't let anything hit anything down here. Don't let planes fall out of the sky. And I don't remember exactly what you said, but I remember you talking to us and I can't remember what you played, but it was such an incredible, I've got Jesus shivers just talking about it. A moment of incredible solace. It was the moment that I really felt, you know, after having been there for a decade, that Chicago really was my home because of people like you, Terry, and that just walked me down into the building. And then, you know, I think it was probably 24 hours until I was driving back home again. But I'll never forget that, how you just talked to us in your calm voice, but you were not just reading news at us, you were actually talking to a whole city that was in shock, a whole world that was in shock.
Well, we were in shock too. That's the hard part. But
you were still, were you still out on the west side? You weren't in the big tall building downtown.
Belmont and Cicero, so we were safe there. Nobody was gonna
was your radio station at that point actively continuing to play music, or it had it temporarily turned into like a news station?
Well, when I first got there, the second tower just started collapsing because I didn't know it till I got my car and I put on BEZ, the public radio station, and they were very calmly talking about a plane hitting a tower. And I thought, do they mean those little towers out in Iowa where they store the corn, you know, the silos?
Or a cell phone tower.
Yeah, I didn't, you know, a tower, what's a tower? And I didn't know it was a World Trade Center, which I had just visited 3 weeks before that. I spent an afternoon there and it was very bizarre. But by the time I got there, I found out what happened. And then when I walked in the door, we didn't have a TV in the studio. Now we do. Because I said, we need a TV in here. Somebody get a TV. We need to see what's going on right now. And the second tower fell when I was taking over for Lynn. So I stayed on with music for about an hour. Then we simulcasted our news station, BBM. And then we called everybody in, all the whole air staff. And from noon to six, we were sitting on stools around the studio. And this is not a talk radio station. We don't take calls and have people. No. And we didn't even screen the calls. We took calls for 6 hours.
Did you really?
And I will never forget that. And I will never forget that. It was just, and there wasn't one single jerk on the phone that called in. Mm-hmm. Everybody was unbelievably, you know, compassionate, you know, and not, and then I turn on one of our sister stations and the jerk is going on about, I'm going to carpet bomb the Middle East and anybody wearing a towel on their head, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I just started screaming at the radio, but that's exactly the opposite. I remember one song that I played.
I was going to ask, if you remembered what you played.
And then I got really mad, and I'll tell you in a second here, but I was really upset because this is a good example for my students that I read in the Tribune, somebody did an article on how radio stations responded to 9/11. And it was right when it was still raw. And they said, and I tuned in XRT and they were playing another blues song, just really dismissive. You know what that blues song was? It was Pop Staples' Hope in a Hopeless World.
That's right.
And that's the one song I remember playing because that was the most appropriate song to play. And this jerk, instead of picking up the phone and saying, what was that blues song you were playing? And then I could have set him straight. He didn't do his homework. You're a journalist. You know, you should have followed up on that.
Absolutely.
It made me crazy.
I would never have just said another blues song, please.
You know, and it was very dismissive and it really kind of pissed me off.
Well, music has the power to do all kinds of things.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, yeah.
It's so short-sighted to think that the only thing that would be comforting is hearing people talk endlessly about what's happening.
An appropriate
for
song
some people, like clearly for 6 hours, your guests called in. So they definitely did need to do some verbal processing, but that is not the only thing people need in a crisis.
But it was very healing though. It was really, and it was so unusual for us. We never did it before or after.
Did doing that, did playing any of these songs, change how you feel about them because you played them at this specific
juncture? I'll remember it forever. Whenever I hear that song or even hear Pops, I think of 9/11.
Do you have any other songs that are like that for other time periods? What did you play when Lennon died?
Oh, well.
Are you on the air yet?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Oh, yeah. In fact, I had taught a class that morning at Columbia. And I remember walking in and the kids started crying. The whole class, they all started crying. And they didn't think I was going to show up. And I said, of course I'm going to show up. I'm not going to leave you stranded here. And I've got to go do an air shift after this. So, and one of the kids did an oral report on Sam Cooke. I was just telling my students about this the other night because we were watching the song, A Change is Going to Come. And I said, they did a report on Sam Cooke. They played that song. And we all just started crying and I had to leave the room for a minute. It was just unbelievable. The kids were so great. And then I left there and walked into the station out of Belmont and everybody was waiting in the vestibule and they all started crying and hugging. And then all three TV networks were there. And that was bizarre because it's like you're standing there watching your house burn down and somebody puts a mic in your face. How do you feel? You know? and so then I said, give me a minute. And I went in and shut the door and set my typewriter and wrote the first thing I was going to say, like the first break. Because I knew if I got in there, I'd lose it. And I didn't want to lose it. I didn't want to lose it. It wasn't my job to lose it. It was my job to keep it together. So
could lose it.
Yes, so they could lose it. Mm-hmm. And I had time to lose it later. So, but I sat there, wrote it. And so I read that as the first thing when I got on the air. And one of the news people stayed and listened because he didn't get it. He said, this is a rock star. I said, no, he's more than a rock star. And I said, come in the studio. He was the only one that didn't ask me stupid questions. And people were saying, did you ever meet John? I go, that's not what this is about, whether or not I met John. You know, was John your favorite Beatle? Yes, but that's not what we need to be talking about right now. And so I let the other two go. And the other guy invited him in. And we had like this little toggle switch thing we could talk on a speakerphone when people call in, so our hands are free doing queuing up records and stuff. It was still before CDs. And And he sat in the corner and just listened to people calling in. And we didn't put those on the air, but he listened to that thing I read at the beginning and then people calling in. And it totally changed his perception and his report. And I'm glad to say he really got it. He stayed.
Do you still have that, Terry, what you read? God, I'd love to see that.
No, this is before computers, so
I know.
The typewriter, piece of paper.
I don't know where anything is.
That's what I was thinking too. I was like, that thing deserves to be in a museum, in a broadcast museum somewhere.
It does. Mm-hmm. Actually,
I remember how I ended it, and it was Johnny, we hardly knew ye. I took that Jack Kennedy quote, and I remember that we got hundreds. I mean, and that was a big deal back then. Now it's not so much, but we got hundreds of letters, people sending self-addressed stamped envelopes. They wanted a copy of it. And I personally myself wrote a little note for each one and folded it up and sent it out. And
just a DJ my ass.
Right?
Please.
Well, they wouldn't let me be a priest, so I'd do this instead.
And this is what I love about this show is everyone does the same thing where they're like, well, I'm not really an artist. I'm just this or that or this other thing. And then we always get to this moment where we're like, hey, yeah, that was pretty artsy for you.
You
took emotion and translated it into the medium that you used, you know, your medium was talking and picking the right songs.
Right.
And you did that. You spoke words that you felt that people were needing to hear in that moment. And played a song that you felt was conscious of that feeling.
Right.
And
it's my job.
What could you
say to the world? And maybe you didn't have your own words, but Pops did. So that's
right.
Yeah. You know,
that's been my experience my whole life with music is that it's able to say the things that I don't have words for.
Speak for you.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, the sound too, the sonic aspect of it too is different.
For sure.
It really
were you musical when you were little?
Oh, Jay, yeah.
I forget.
Oh, yeah.
What did
you
play?
French horn and guitar. I was in some rock bands, And
on the French horn or the guitar?
No, the guitar.
Oh, I was like, please say French horn.
but when Revolver came out and they had Britain's best French horn player, Alan Civil, play on For No One. I was beside myself because I was still in high school. I was still in the Mozart horn quartet we had, you know, in the band and orchestra. And and I was in a lot of choirs. I love choral music. In fact, that's why I quit doing rock because I don't like to stand up and sing in front of people. I'd rather be one of 65 people and blend. And and actually, it was kind of a great contrast that kept me grounded with this radio thing that couldn't really mess with your head if you let it. But I was brought up by nuns. I wasn't going to let it mess me up that way. But I love the aspect of being in the choir. And once I got up there, I wasn't Terry Hemmert anymore. I was an alto. I was surrounded by people that I loved. And you know how they say...
An integral part of a group.
Yeah. And St. Augustine said, singing is praying twice. And he's right. And when I quit the choir because of politics and a whole choir director. We won't go there.
Then I would say Clements or before.
Yeah, at Clements. Wait. And I would go to mass and sit and hear the choir sing. And it was depressing because I wanted to be singing with them. And mass wasn't the same. I had to totally readjust the way I, you know.
Well, your perspective was literally different because you weren't sitting in the choir loft, right?
And I'm still, my best friends are still people from the choir from 30 years ago.
Wow. St. Clements, for folks who aren't in Chicago, St. Clements is a Catholic church that's right in the heart of what, I guess, do they still call it Boys Town?
Lincoln Park. No, Lincoln Park. We're
it's
further
in Lincoln
south.
Park. Yeah. It's Lincoln Park.
It's on the border.
It's known for its music and just being a vibrant part of the community.
Oh, it's an amazing, amazing parish. And is this a religious show at all? Can I get religious here?
Yeah, but you can.
You can talk about whatever you want.
Step into the confessional.
Yeah, well, that's what brought me back to the church. I found St. Clements, and my sister died in an auto accident when she was 19 years old, and I was 13 years older than her. I felt like I raised her. When I left for college, she started kindergarten, so I went, did it. I'm done. I'm off to college now. My other sister, who's still with us, thank God, she was in first grade, so I felt like I got them into school. Now I got to go school myself. And we were very close, and she was my baby, and she was killed instantly in this horrible car accident when she was away at college.
So sorry.
And thank you. And it was devastating. And I had just done 2 weeks of morning drive. and then this happens. Mm. And some other stuff in my life that I won't talk about anymore. I'm past it. But it was a rough time. And I remembered St. Clement's. I went there for Palm Sunday Mass once because I missed going to Mass. I loved Mass, but I couldn't stand the Catholic Church. I couldn't stand the homilies I sat through in Ohio.
A lot of people feel that way.
If you support the ERA, you're anti-family, anti-God, you know. No. If you're not married, procreating, you're anti-family. No, I'm not anti-family. As my niece was sitting on my lap, you know, no, I'm not anti-family. Mm-hmm. And so I said, I've had enough. I can't do this anymore. And then my mom and I had a knockdown drag out, which I was surprised. I didn't think she, you know, no, I was old enough to make those decisions. And she was really upset with me. And I said, well, I'm not going back there anymore. They bullied me when I was in school. It was a horrible place. And then 3 weeks later, I was back there for my sister's funeral. Mm. It was right after Christmas. and then I went to that Palm Sunday Mass because I missed the liturgy. I didn't miss the church and the hierarchy and all. I missed the liturgy because I didn't lose my faith in God. I lost my faith in the church. Big difference.
Yes.
And somebody said, go to St. Clement's. And I went and the priest invited us at the very beginning to come up and stand around the altar if we wanted to. And I was by myself. So I went up there and I stood by the altar and it blew my mind because I always wanted to be a server. I memorized all the Latin responses so that my fifth grade teacher taught them to me so that they changed the rules. I could go right off the bench. Put me in, coach. I know all the Latin responses.
Eucharistic minister, I know all the lines.
Yes, I got it. And I loved it.
That isn't the greatest like catchphrase ever. Is like, if they change the rules, I'm off the bench.
Yeah. I was all ready to go. And of course, by the time they changed the rules, I was an adult and they weren't doing Latin anymore. So go figure. But anyway. Ooh. But I was standing there and it was so emotional. That's the closest I'd ever come to participating in a Mass. Mm. And I went up to this priest. He's long departed, but we became great friends a couple of years later. I went to that priest after Mass and I said, you know, I'm like 30 some years old, a long time Catholic since I was born. I've never stood that close to the altar before in my life. And I can't tell you how that much that meant to me. But I thought I was never going to go back. And then Joni died and nothing was helping. So I thought, I'm going to go to Mass. If I just go to Mass for 6 months, I'll be fine. That was 1981. I'm still going back there. Of course, I can't go now.
Did it? Did 6 months do it, or did you need more than 6 months?
I need the rest of my life, you know. And the people I met there, and I went to All Souls Day. They did the choir did the Ferre Requiem as part of the Mass, not as a concert piece.
Oh,
and
wow.
I brought a friend of mine that wasn't Catholic but loved classical music. And I remember I sat there and I wept through the whole thing, but it was a good weep.
Mm.
And cathartic. Yes, it was so beautiful, and I felt so comforted. Mm. And it turns out some of the people I knew in choir later were in the children's choir that did the In Paradisum at the end, you know, and I didn't even know them then. And Father Oldershaw, Bob Oldershaw, you know, he loves you, and you love him, and I love him. And anyway, he was the conductor of the children's choir. And I thought, oh, he gives great homilies and he also does a children's choir. He's pretty cool. And we've become great friends ever since. And that really had an impact on me. So then they find, I'm getting too much into religion.
That's all right. No, because
okay.
What I was just saying is that the music was able to do something for you that no doctrine or theology would have at that time.
That was going to be my next question. Yeah. Is the choir music at church the only music that does that for you?
No.
Or do you think there are other, is there other music that specifically changes? Like, do you have an example of like when that music has changed you in your life?
Well, Beatles for sure. Cause that's why I got into radio. I didn't get into radio to save people from, you know, slitting their wrists at 3 o'clock in the morning. I didn't know about any of that.
That was an unexpected benefit.
Yeah.
Being able to help.
Yeah.
It's
a matter of improvising once you get into something and figure out, oh, I could do this and I could do this and that would be good. And just figuring it out on the way. But I got into radio to meet the Beatles. That was my
mission accomplished. I was going to ask if you were a huge Beatles fan before radio, or if the radio job helped kind of like
the chicken and egg was the Beatles first and then the radio, right?
Well, radio was around before. I wasn't in it, but I was a high school kid. I was
That's how you heard the Beatles.
I was a sophomore. Well, I loved radio before the Beatles. I was a big Soul fan. And when I was junior high, I was a huge Coasters fan. Oh, my God. I was conning all my aunts to buy me the latest single because I had no money. And I would do all my mom's ironing, and I would have the radio on. I knew I was a nerd. I would buy records when I could and then listen to the B-side. Nobody did that, you know,
in my
town.
You did.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I was a nerd. I looked to see who wrote the songs, you know. And as I was telling my students the other night, and I feel like I came from the dark ages, I said, you couldn't Google any of this. You couldn't go onto YouTube and look it up. When I saw J.L. Hooker wrote a song on an Animals album that I loved, I thought, who's J.L. Hooker? I don't know that name. Well, you couldn't go to the library and look it up. The teen magazines weren't writing about John Lee Hooker.
No.
You know, and so you had to really be active.
How did you figure out who John Lee Hooker was?
Well, talk to
I moved to Chicago. I left Piqua.
It took a while.
I went to college. I went to Elmhurst, the school where we make fun of Wheaton all the time. Yeah. But, you know,
thank God the internet exists. This sounds like a nightmare to me.
Well, it is a nightmare. But
it got me into it.
Yeah.
I have to wonder, considering the time period that you came from, which was slightly before mine and Kathleen's, but we also were pre-internet.
I'm a lot older
when we were growing up. And I wonder if you are a fan in the way that you are of music because there were so few streams and so little access to it. You could only get it through the radio or if you bought albums, but you didn't have a diversification of ways of getting it. So you were really captive to the one or two ways that you actually had access to.
That could be. I think bigger than that, though, was the fact that my mom was a musician, so I was a music fan before rock and roll came around. I mean, I just totally was into music.
Classical? Yeah.
She was classical. She played organ and piano, and she taught. Teaching was her passion. She's the one that taught me how to be a teacher. And she also taught me with her choir that music builds community. And that's why I have those potluck dinners at my house, because it built community. And that's why I love being ombudsman. I love being ombudsman. It was like me being a little Betty, you know, all the stuff Betty taught me. But as a child, I would go to choir practices just to hear the practice and just to hear these incredible adults of all different music abilities make great music together. That's where I got into gospel music. My mom loved gospel, and we did what they called Negro spirituals. Mm. And, I have a story I want to share with you because this story should go beyond my classroom, which is where I usually share it. But years ago, this guy who was a librarian, we got to be really good friends. He came out. He wasn't from Piqua, so I didn't know him from Piqua. He called me. He was coming to a library convention in Chicago and wanted to know if we could get together for dinner. I said, sure. Well, he was a conservative Republican, very Christian, capital C. You know, we should have been punching each other out. We really hit it off. And I love that. I love that so much. Mm-hmm. And we're losing that right now. And I'm working on Facebook to get people to remember how to communicate, you know. Let's agreeable.
Lord's work right now.
And we need to be reminded of it, because I can fall into, if I'm having a bad day, you know, I can fall into that too. So I'm reminding myself, practice what you preach. But this guy was great, and he did this whole Piqua wing in the library, which I loved, that he was digging into the town history. So he said, I want to get involved with a project with you. What would you want to do? And I said, let's get a reunion of the Piqua Community Chorus. So all the little hometown newspapers all around South Western Ohio had an article about it, and we got people coming from all over the place. So they'd write to somebody three states away who used to be in the Piqua Community Chorus, and we actually had a lot of people show up, and we went to the Park District place where we used to rehearse. Mom found a file cabinet full of music that they picked the lock, and it was music we used to sing. And it was a potluck. People brought potluck food. I told them.
A good potluck.
Yeah, and we sang. But the cool thing is we did stories. We went around the circle and told stories. Mom told this story that she'd never told me before. I don't know if she ever told anybody before. And I tell it every year in my class when we get to gospel music, because gospel is one of the genres we focus on, because it's, you wouldn't have soul music without gospel, you know. And I always have to tell them, I'm not proselytizing, but, you know, but the story, one time we were doing this song called Listen to the Lambs, Hear Them Cry. And it was just heartbreakingly beautiful. But, you know, there's this imagery of the Lamb of God, or Jesus is the Good Shepherd, always, you know, won't go home till he finds that lost lamb in the bush, you know. And so that's what we thought we were singing about. And one night, Wilson Jefferson, who was this tall, dignified African-American man who was the butler for the rich family on the hill, and a wonderful gentleman, just a lovely man. And he came up to my mom after rehearsal one night and said, Mrs. Hemmert, he never called her Betty. She said, call me Betty. No, Mrs. Hemmert. You know, he's very proper. He said, Mrs. Hemmert, you know what that song's about? And Listen to the Lambs. And she goes, no, what? And he said, it's about how during slave days, the people would be out picking cotton, and there'd be a few people watching all the babies because they didn't have daycare, you know, all the infants and toddlers and stuff. And ever so often, without any warning, one of the foremen would come through with a horse and cart, and they would load up the healthy children into the cart and take them off to sell them. And I told my students,
another layer of terrible.
Yeah. And I told my students the horrific experience of any time I saw my parents bury my sister. So I know the worst thing is that for a parent to lose a child, and to know not only they would never see that kid again, but what kind of horror were they going to live through, being sold on a market, not having somebody look out for them and care for them. And so they were singing in church because they couldn't resist. They couldn't say, stop it. You MF, you know, bring my kid back. So at church, and this is the beauty of gospel music, it was liberation music. It was music that they were singing about things they couldn't talk about, even talk about. Right. And Listen to the Lambs, Hear Them Cry is their response to hearing their children crying as they were being taken down that road. I tell my students, I said that music was so powerful that that was their therapy. That was the only way they could process that. And so when they were singing, Go Down Moses, Tell Pharaoh to Let My People Go, and the guy in the big house was saying, oh, the darkies are singing about Moses and the Pharaoh. No, he was Pharaoh. He didn't know it. And they were singing about him, you know, calling on the plagues to come back, you know, and the boll weevil and all that. But that's why that music is so powerful, because it comes from here. You know, it comes from the heart and the gut and the, and
trauma.
it's So that song to me was worth the whole reunion.
Oof, I love the idea of a community choir right now. That just seems like you might as well be talking about planting petunias on Neptune, because that's like the farthest thing from what a lot of us could imagine doing. Yeah. I wanted to ask you, this is such a weird time, and so many of us are so very isolated because
it's a weird time. Why is it such a weird time?
Because it's so warm.
Just today, actually.
But you know, when you were talking about wanting to be in the choir and what singing in a choir feels like for you and what that does, which is different from other, I also love that, and I haven't sung in a choir in far too long. I always think about it when I try out a new church, if they've got a decent choir, I'm like, maybe this one, and then something always happens and it never works out.
What part do you sing? What do you sing?
I'm a soprano, but not high. But I can also sing alto. I'm in between. Story of my life. Not quite that. Not quite that either.
You know, we have a lot super of soprano special jokes in our choir, you know. I'll spare you.
Oh gosh, yeah. But what made me think about that is, like, one of the things I miss most, and I know you do too, from previous conversations, is live music right now. Like going,
oh my God,
hearing anything. And part of what I love about that experience is because I'm not experiencing it by myself. I'm around other people. Even if somebody's being obnoxious and drunk and spilling a whatever, when people sing together, even if it's off key and terrible, God, that's magic. And there aren't very many places in this contemporary world where we're allowed, and I'm making air quotes, to do that. But singing in a choir in church, mm-hmm. or singing in a worship service in a house of worship, and singing with strangers at concerts at are concerts. Places where we get to do that, and we don't get to do that other places. And Mark has a point.
Also karaoke.
Yes, but that's, yes, it's performative, though. Yes.
Somebody had to go there.
But we can't do that either right now.
And people are usually not singing with you in karaoke.
No, I only, I refuse. So I grew up in choir. Like, I spent 4 years in choir.
That's right.
I have sung for a long time. I have competed on a
little known facts about Mark.
Are you a soprano?
I was
neither here nor there.
I started as a bass and then moved to a very beautiful tenor, and now I'm like somewhere in the middle of like I can't do either of those really well.
Well, what about pre-puberty? Pre-puberty, were you a soprano?
Pre-puberty, I was a bass. I was a lower.
No, what?
A lower registered. Yeah, yeah. Oh. Well, like pre-puberty.
Not easy for you to say. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Pre-puberty, you were a bass, and then you had your hormones tested? Because I'm a little concerned.
They're not good. I'm not going to say that.
Okay.
But
they're not good.
But so I don't. But I quit choir because I hate. I have like horrible stage fright.
Yeah.
And so I told people, I was like, I will only. They're like, do some karaoke, do that song, and I was like, I'll do a duet with you. But you have to come up with me, because I will never do one on my own. Because I also feel it's like very contrived, and people usually only karaoke when they're like, check me out.
Yes. And so it's a performative thing.
It's not right. Me. Yeah.
We toured with all those people.
Right, exactly. I used to date a singer, and she was amazing. And she's an incredible singer, but she would do a hip hop version of Ice Ice Baby, but like spoken word. And it works really well. And you're like, people are like, lines. Oh, she's going to sing. Oh,
we can't afford it. He always tells me, don't sing that. We can't afford the rides.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay.
But she would do it, and it was great. And like, everyone didn't expect it, because they were like, she's going to sing something pretty. And she did not.
I had stage fright too. And even with choir concerts, because, you know, you don't want to be the one coming in on the rest.
No. You know?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it could happen to anybody.
You've stood up there on stages, because I've seen you so many times, and introduced every band and musical act known to man.
Yeah, and I get nervous sometimes, but you know, that's adrenaline. That's okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like when I have to give speeches somewhere where I've never given a speech before or accept an award, I'm like, feel like I'm going to throw up.
Mm. Right. Is it just the newness of the experience, or
it's just fear? Fear of me just totally collapsing and just being real.
Is that sort of thing what kept you from wanting to be a professional musician?
No, I just realized my limitations, that there were a lot of really fantastic musicians that couldn't make a living doing it. And I lost my band in college. The Buckets broke up. They got
the Buckets broke up. Yeah, Why did the Buckets break up?
Well, one of them got pregnant.
Who were the Buckets?
Call them out. One of them got pregnant.
One got pregnant, and the other two got. Well, we were all on academic probation because we were spending way too much time. That was one of the highlights of my life, when I went from academic probation to dean's list in 2 years, and then got an honorary doctorate 2 years ago. I said,
divine reversal. Look at that.
The president of Elmhurst College, who I didn't know at the time, called me to ask if I would accept a doctorate. The first thing I said on the phone was, "You aren't calling to tell me I'm back on academic probation, are you?" And he said, "No, exactly. No, but." The Buckets were an Elmhurst College group. And
what kind of music was it, Terry?
Well, I used to call it psychedelic barbershop. We had to rely heavily on harmonies.
That's the title for this. Yep, there it is.
Only because...
For a pregnant bucket. I'll go with that
right,
one, too.
Oh, no. Yeah. Yeah. No, but... The Buckets were so unique. They were so wonderful, and it was so short-lived. It was only a year. But when I met Tom Paxton years ago, a great folk singer, classic guy from the 60s scene that I was a big fan of, I met him backstage at Ravinia a few years ago, and I said, you probably don't remember 1968, you played the Wilder Park Folk Festival in Elmhurst. You probably don't remember there was a group that opened for you called the Buckets. And... And we had a song we wrote called the Wilder Park Blues, which brought the place down. I mean, it was just because we were singing it in Wilder Park. It was about
they love that. Audiences love hearing themselves referenced.
Yeah. We're there, the like Chicago, you know,
for sure.
Sweet Hope Chicago, you know. But we sang this, and it was a song about getting mugged in Wilder Park and liking it. You know, it was it was pretty. In fact, it got banned from our campus station because Dr. Lowe said it wasn't conducive to an educational experience. So, okay, whatever. But I loved him.
Wow.
He was a wonderful man. But no, we got a lot of airplay on the campus station. We had gigs. We were like, in 1 year's time, we went from nothing to, you know, really having
was
a following.
Was it all female?
Yeah, four of us, yeah. And I played acoustic guitar, and we got a kazoo for when I'm 64. And we wrote mostly our own stuff. We did a version of Money with the soul clap, a cappella, like this. And
nice.
The harmonies were mind-blowing. 10 years later, I was at Tuts watching the Roaches. Remember the Roaches?
Oh, yeah, the sisters from Canada, right?
Yeah. No, that's the McGarrigles.
Sorry.
That's the McGarrigles. Who I adore.
We have the Roach Christmas album, which Maury loves, and
they are connected to the McGarrigles. They work together, but the Roaches are sisters, and they harmonize beautifully. But I was watching them, and I thought, screw this, man! If the Buckets had stayed together, we'd be the Roaches now, because we harmonized like that. We were funny like they were, and they did an a cappella version of the Hallelujah Chorus. The Buckets in 1968 did it.
Jeez, stolen.
We rewrote the lyrics. We would do parody songs. In fact, I never got one. I don't know what happened to my. See, I don't know where any of my stuff is. The reason I had this screen is like,
please tell me there's recordings.
I was going to say, are there recordings?
Oh yeah, we have recordings.
Man.
But not all of them. We don't have our hit that I wrote when I was in high school. That was a ballad that people weep, and they played it on the campus station all the time. They got requests. But
what was it? Terry, what was that ballad?
Do you still have the music for it?
No. It's in my head.
It was written on paper, remember?
I never wrote anything down. But anyway, what we would do in addition to that, we would do parody songs. So in 1968, you couldn't have men in your dorm room. But there were certain high holy days where we could allow men in, but you had to keep the door open ajar, you know.
Oh my God. So I love it. A high holy day will allow a man to be in your room.
Yeah, right. That was sort of a Wheaton dig, but anyway.
Yes, it was. Because I'm like, in 1988, you couldn't have men in your dorm room at Wheaton.
No. Yeah, right. So anyway.
Just love the dichotomy.
No, the whole thing is, though, we would take these issues, that and the possibility of flunking out, getting a academic probation. We would take issues like that and give my regards to Broadway and the Hallelujah Chorus and all this kind of things. And we rewrite it and do a mock cappella, and people were falling down laughing. They just loved it. Well, when I saw the Roaches were singing Hallelujah Chorus with the original lyrics, they weren't even clever enough to rewrite them like we did. I thought, wait a minute, it should be us. We should be playing Tuts. But I saw one of the Buckets. You know Taye Diggs, the movie star?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
His mother was one of the Buckets, Marty Bucket. Well, this is the other thing. This is the other thing. The Ramones, you know, Ramones isn't their last name. They, you know, Joey Ramone, Johnny Ramone. It was Terry Bucket, Marty Bucket, Lindy Bucket, Nancy Bucket. We did that 10 years early, too. And Marty Bucket had she didn't get... Her pregnancy wasn't the one that blew up the group, but she did get pregnant with somebody out in Los Angeles. So she had a little boy named him L.A., little Andre or Los Angeles. He grew up to be Taye Diggs.
Yeah, he did.
And so when they moved to Rochester, and she was a single mom, and I got a job offer my first 2 years on the air in Rochester, I grabbed the job because I could, you know, Nancy Bucket was there, Lindy Bucket was downstate, and we were all in the same state, you know, so that was a big thing, and I could help raise her son. So he used to call me Aunt Terry all the time. So that goes back. But anyway, Marty, Thanksgiving, this coming Thanksgiving, is 2 year anniversary, she died very suddenly. Marty and I had rekindled our friendship. She and her daughter used to come out here and stay with me all the time. She was working on her PhD. She was supposed to get it last spring and died before she got it. And I'd say, what are you going to do with that? She said, well, I'll be 72 and then I'll just look for a job. I said, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, fine. Very reasonable.
But she wanted to do it. But she was on August Wilson, and she the playwright, oh, wow. and she would come to Chicago because since the Goodman did all of his plays,
yeah,
right. a lot of resources, and she would like live in my basement on my rollout bed with a big screen TV and watch all my DVDs when she'd go to sleep, and we were spending weeks together, and I introduced her to Mavis Staples, and they really hit it off, and Mavis said, "Nice meeting you, but where's your son? I want to see your cute son," you know. And good old Mavis, I love her. And so Marty and I were, in fact, the last phone call. Oh my God, this is Kathleen. The last phone call, I was driving down Lake Street from Oak Park to the city and under the L tracks, yeah. like you were the 9/11. And I was talking to her on the phone. We had this great, because they did a mural about Val Camaletti, you know, yes. our dear friend Val. Oh, dear and I went out, Val. I went out for that. And I was feeling really good because I saw a lot of people that used to work at Val's Hala, and it was a Val would have loved it. It was beautiful. So I was driving home and I called Marty and woke her up. It was like noon. I said, "Wake up." And we had the best talk. And at the end, she said, "You know, I never had siblings, but you're the closest I ever came to having a sister." Well, mm-hmm. she was in a play off Broadway in New York and really good reviews and stuff. And she wasn't feeling good, went to the doctor. And within the week, she was gone. Mm-hmm. She had liver cancer, didn't know it.
Oh my gosh.
We didn't get to say goodbye, which freaked me out. I found out like 2 days before she died. And so then in February, and this is just February 2020, they had a memorial for her in New Jersey. So I called the other two buckets. I said, "You guys are coming." "Oh, I don't know if I..." "You're getting there."
"Get in the car, buckets."
Yeah. I mean, you know, and one of them, she didn't have a car. And so I said, "Get on a Greyhound bus. I don't care, but you know, I'll come pick you up at the bus station. Just I'm paying for the hotel room for all three of us. Get down here." And then she said, "Well, I'll go rent a car." I said, "Fine." Well, she didn't know you had to have a credit card to rent a car. So she took Greyhound. But anyway, it turned out we had a great time. And Marty's five kids were there. So I got to see mm-hmm. Tay again. And Tay is just a lovely man. And so anyway, I talked to her daughter. I said, "Do you want us to do a bucket thing?" And she said, "Yeah." Oh no, she called me, said, "Would the buckets do something?" I said, "Oh, we were going to do it anyway, you know." I mean, you didn't have to ask. You
cannot keep a bucket down.
Well, you can't. And she needed to be honored for being in the buckets, because I was going to tell you, they made a flexi-disc record of some of our parody songs and put them in a yearbook. So I was talking about the buckets once.
Flexi-disc.
Yeah. And I was speaking to
like a record that could bend.
It's like a little piece of paper, but it's like they could put the sound grooves in it. Yeah, ooh. Yeah. And you could put on your turntable.
So I guarantee you that's out there somewhere.
Oh yeah, yes. It is. But I do have some MP3s, because the day before I left to go out to New Jersey, our manager Tom, who lives in Madison, finally found, none of us could find our copy of the CD he made for us like 10 years before. We've misplaced it. He couldn't find his. He finally found it. He drove from Madison, dropped off the CD so I could burn it and give it back to him. We had lunch at Aunt Sather's and he drove back to Madison. The next day I got on the plane and drove to New Jersey. So we played a couple of the songs at Marty's memorial service. Her kids and all these other theater people that she knew from all different aspects of her life, they had never heard her sing. And she was the best singer of the four of us. Oh, she was amazing. Wow. And she never sang after the buckets. And she had so much talent.
She was
charisma.
On stage, but not ever in a role where they had her sing?
Nope.
Wow.
Nope.
Wow.
And and that was like such a gift. Plus I gave the copy of the CD to one of the kids and said, "Make copies, you know, so you have this." But we got up and told stories about the buckets, and people were just rolling on the floor, and it went great. I mean, it was like one of the highlights. It was the highlight.
Yeah.
It was really fun.
Marty stories. Marty Bucket stories.
Because, you know, I came back and then all of a sudden COVID hit and everything else is a blur.
Was that your last trip, Terry?
That was my last trip. I got back just a couple weeks before, you know why.
Zoinks. Yeah.
Yeah. In fact, if it had been a month later, we couldn't have gone. They would have had to cancel it.
Wow.
And it was an amazing, these other Elmhurst people came and it was like a dorm, you know, in the Best Western. I found out, I was on the phone. I said, "Oh, what room are they in?" And she told me, I said, "That's two doors down. Bye." And I hung up and I went, knocking on the door, Beanie Raid. And that was at Elmhurst during orientation. You wake the kids up in the middle of the night, and they'd put on their Elmhurst beanie with their rule book and come out in the hallway and sing for us.
We did not have beanies at Wheaton.
I'm sure you
probably
didn't.
Because of Jesus or something.
Yeah. Thank God, actually. Yeah. I'm not a huge fan of hair. Beanie.
Me
yeah.
neither. It's
they might have thought it was a yarmulke, and that would have been.
Oh, God. No, yeah, not that.
Didn't want to go there. Yeah.
So, well, okay. So, yeah. in this weird time that this year has been, the longest year, and it's been a kind of a crappy few years with loss for both of us, actually, and Caitlin, too. Caitlin lost her mom. And, you know, and now we're at this time where we can't do the things that we love.
Any of the things
we love to do.
Ever.
But is there anything that you've found in the last many months that brings you that solace or brings you that joy? Not in the same way, but something akin to watching, being at a concert or singing in a choir, or what have you been consuming since you've been largely home alone?
Yeah, because I am home alone. Because you know, but I think that's better than being home with somebody you're really sick of and you never want to see again.
That is true. That is the truth.
It's not a convenient time to I'm not complaining.
And having your own space is huge. Also, Mark and I can attest to the trials of being a nomad and how awful it is during COVID.
Jeez.
As he's sitting there in the closet, you know.
Yes. So, what do you mean? Everything's fine. It's fine. Yeah.
The listeners can't see, but we're doing this from my closet. I'm in the closet.
Broadcasting from a closet on Capitol Hill. You
know, it's going to be great.
It's very, very classy.
There are worse places.
It's very classy. Is that a brassiere that's hanging behind you?
I see a helmet. Okay. I think it's a mask.
No, that's our rack of masks, because that's a thing you have now in 2020.
Yes,
is a place to store all your masks.
That's true. Oh, before I answer that question, can I give people a helpful tip? And this happened right outside Ann Sather's. I don't pull out my wallet anymore to give money to people on the street, because I'm just afraid somebody's going to come up from behind and, you know, grab my wallet, because everybody's desperate for money. So, and this woman was begging, and I said, oh, I'm sorry, I don't have any change or anything. And then I got to my car and I thought, so I pulled around front and I got a couple dollars out, and I went over and gave them to her, and she was so thankful. And I know right before I said goodbye to her, I said, God bless you. And she looked at me like, oh, God bless you too. It was like a real, like, it wasn't just, you know, random talk. We connected. So I gave her a couple bucks, and I said, and she had a mask on, but I said, do you need some more masks? And she said, yeah, well, I just gone to Costco, which, since Tower Records is gone, Costco is my favorite place to go. And I buy in bulk, and I live alone. Go figure. But I bought a box of the disposable masks the other day, and I realized when I opened it up because I thought I should have some in the car just in case, you know.
Yeah.
And they were in 10 packs, you know, 10 masks in each little pack, and then 5 packs. And I went in my car, and I pulled out the 10 pack, and I gave it to her, and she was so thrilled. Like 10 masks, you know, that's going to last her. And so I've been telling my friends, where you go to Costco, get that box, and then have them ready in your car, and you see somebody's homeless, give them some masks.
That's a great idea.
That might save their life, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
they're hard enough to find when you it's masks.
Jeez. And they're nice little pack, all, you know, in a little bag stuff. So anyway, I was going to, the things that keep me sane. One is I adopted a new cat. Like two days before they shut down everything. I mean, and this had been in the progress. This friend of mine found this cat, literally rescued her. She had been bitten, and her shoulder was infected, and she was walking on 3 legs. And my friend took her in thinking this would be a perfect cat for Terry, because my precious Irma died last fall after over 20 years together. She was the best. And so, and this one looked like a little Irma. She was a tortie, just like Irma, but totally different disposition and everything. And she'd been holding on to her. And a couple months later, I said, you know, I think I'm ready to start looking for a cat. So if you see one, let me know. She says, oh, she's been living in my basement. Now she needs to be spayed, and then she's ready to go. So I had to wait for a few more weeks for the arm to heal up and all that. Mm-hmm. But I go see her once a week and hold her and pet her and bond with her. She and I got her then, and we were shut down a couple of days later.
Wow.
And she has been amazing. I adore this cat. and she's been great. The other thing is Breakfast with the Beatles. You know, I go.
You're still broadcasting.
I'm still doing that. Yeah, there was 1 month where they wouldn't let me near the place, so they had reruns, and everybody was very sweet about it. Nobody complained.
And you're going into the studio to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
And so we disinfect everything we touch. We have stuff, and I'm there with like one or two other people, with the production guy and Lynn when he's on the air. Marty afterwards.
Lynn Bramer.
Yes, yep. Lynn, who Uncle loves you. He will be very jealous when he finds out I had all this
time. I know. I'm sorry, Lynn. You're also on our list of people to have on the show, but we had to start with
whatever. but doing that Beatles show.
I love
show,
you.
Yeah. But doing that Beatles show really feeds me and inspires me. And I really work hard on it. I spend hours putting it together. It's like Rubik's Cube. You know, it's not just me playing side two of Abbey Road. And
for those who are unfamiliar with it, like, what is the concept of this show?
Oh, well, thank you for asking.
And it's on WXRT 93.1 in Chicago, and you can listen online.
Radio,
WXRT.
Radio.com.
Radio.com.
XRT. Yeah. Thank you.
We'll have that in the show notes also.
Yes, for sure.
Good. Okay. Because we get listeners. I have, my favorite correspondence with the listener right now is this woman from Germany that listens every Sunday afternoon. And she said something about going to Piqua. And I said, are you from Piqua? She said, no, I was an exchange student.
What?
And I was there for a high school reunion like 2 years ago. And I said, wait, were you in the class of 79? And she said, yeah. Not that I know every high school reunion in Piqua every year. Right. But I said, were you in my sister Joni's class?
Oh.
And she said, yes. I said, did you know her? She said, we were in theater together.
Oh, my really gosh. Well. Wow.
And now we've corresponded, and now she's going through chemo. She's having some rough stuff, and she's a lovely person, and we've been corresponding. We've never met. She met my other sister. They always invite. I knew about the reunion. They always invite Julie and I to come, and I never get to go. And Julie went this year for the first time. So, but people are writing in like, oh, Breakfast of the Beatles. It starts my Sunday off, and now that I can't go to church, this is my church. You know, so that's nice. And I really do put it together. It's all Beatle related, but it's not just all Beatles. I'll play cover stuff. I'll play some novelty stuff. I have just
Has COVID changed the way that you structure that?
No.
Has it changed the way that the audience reacts to it?
Yeah, I think everything means more to people. Because, we're all looking for that stuff, and I think, and the third thing I was going to mention is teaching, and I will include Columbia College in that and Facebook, because I'm basically teaching on Facebook, doing a music history class. Well, people have been on me, especially since everything shut down, and the two big things have been on me. I wish you'd teach an adult education course. Well, I need to teach another course like a hole in head, because I'm still busy and I'm not even working now. I'm somewhere retired. It's crazy. But what I really miss is what I do with the Chicago Symphony, that series. It's a monthly classic encounter. And I'm chomping at the bit to get back to that. And that's very time consuming because I have to make things up. There's not even on the internet. There's no place to go like, well, what does Mussorgsky have to do other than with Emerson, Lake, and Palmer? They covered his, but what does Mussorgsky have to do with rock and roll or hip hop or anything? And I have to make it up. I have to hear something, get inspired, and then try to back it up with
facts.
Find
a connection.
Yes. Mm. And so that's a great challenge. I love that. And the audience is wonderful. Some people have been going now for, it's been 16 years, I think, and they've been going that long. And but Facebook, they were saying, teach an extra class. No, I don't have time. Plus I like my kids. I like the kids. Yeah. Everybody else is too old, And plus they know all that anyway, but they want to hear my perspective, whatever. And then the other thing is they want me to write a book about myself. And that's the last thing in the world I want to do. The very last, that's non-negotiable.
Big eyes at Terry right now.
Yeah. Do you have, and I'm not a writer. We've gone over this on the show before. I don't read.
Yeah.
But everybody else on the show as a writer. And so my question to you is, do you not want to write because you don't want to write? Or do you not want to write because you don't like that medium just doesn't appeal to you?
I don't want to write about my life.
Why? You have such an interesting life.
That's what I write on Facebook. But if I wrote a book, I'd have to write all this other stuff that I don't want to go there. I like
maybe you should just collaborate with somebody who would do it as a biography. But
no, I've got the dirt on a lot of people. And
you knew somebody who could do that with you.
Yeah, like could you? No. Would you want to?
No, I don't
want to
go there.
If you could,
I don't want to go there.
You,
yeah. I don't want to.
Would you do it if you could ghostwrite
for the love of God?
I'm only saying this because, like, the idea of like if someone's like, Mark, write a book about your journey. I'd be like, no, I don't. Mm-mm. My arm would hurt after the first paragraph.
No, that's not it. That's not it. But it's just that
you don't want to relive all the things. You want to selectively relive.
And some of those people are still alive, and I don't want to say stuff about them that I would need to say. And I like a little privacy too. There's nothing wrong with that. I have not gone on the air and like people say, well, tell us about, you know, your sex life back when I had one. And, you know, and I said, well, it's none of your business, really. I mean, and they go, yeah, that's who you are. I said, no, who I am is my sister dying.
Yeah.
And you don't want to hear about that because that's depressing. You want to hear about my sex life, but you don't. But that's what affected me, not who, you know, who I was involved with. And it's none of your business. You know, I'm from a small town, Ohio. You didn't talk about stuff like that. And I still hold true to that. I'm just kind of...
I get that. But, I mean, we both know musicians who have gone on and been convinced to write their memoirs.
Tell-alls.
And sometimes, well, memoirs. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they're more tell-all-y and sometimes they're more memoir-ish. Like Springsteen did a hell of a job on his.
He did.
A really, really good job. But, you know, I have a couple of friends who got hoodwinked into doing it and they're just like, it's an albatross. This is not what I signed up for. I don't want to do this.
I'm still living it. And I can't picture somebody wanting to sit down and read the autobiography of a disc jockey. I mean, really, come on. It'd be a cutout. It would be there with Howard Stern's book, cutout, 70% off, you know?
He did very well, though.
I find it interesting when people write their memoirs themselves and not... And aren't so heavily influenced by an editor or someone who's like, oh, you got to include the meaty stuff, you know, the fight that you had with so-and-so. And you're like, that's not what my book is about. My book is about me and what it takes to be me. And so when people want to go, what does it take to be Rod Stewart? Well, read Rod Stewart's autobiography and find out. But if all of it is like the fights Rod had, that might be what turned him into Rod. But I think mostly it's like the idea of what makes Rod want to, you know, get up and sing or get up and play the guitar or get up and do this and that.
Yeah.
And so I wonder if someone wouldn't want to hear your story just because you are such an interesting, you know, you're not just a character, you're an interesting personality.
I'm a character.
And
you are a character. You are many
I'm not going to say you're not.
Also
you know?
A character.
It got me in trouble in school all the time. Class clown.
And so what, you know, someone's going to see themselves in you. I mean, that's kind of the idea of the show is that someone will see themselves on this show and they'll listen and they'll say, wow, that's exactly how I feel about that thing.
Right. Well, I'm doing that now on Facebook.
And people love it.
Tell me more about that because Kathleen knows obviously, but what exactly, how does that work on Facebook for you?
Well, I started doing this a couple years ago when they took my Christmas special away on the radio. I used to I played the Mills Brothers.
It was so good.
Classical music. I played everything. It was wonderful. And this is one of the reasons I don't want to write a book because it really pissed me off the way they did it and the fact they did it. And, you know, sometimes every place, even a wonderful place like XRT could be toxic, you know, and I just don't want to go there. So what I started doing, and people were freaking out. They thought I just didn't want to do it anymore. I go, no, and I can't say my boss is a jerk.
Because you retired.
This was before
the Christmas thing.
And people used to say we would schedule our unwrapping the presents around your show, so because everybody loved it because it was something for everybody, every generation. You know, Duke Ellington's Nutcracker Suite, play something from that. You know, and then Bruce, and then you know whatever. And it was great fun, and I had this huge collection of Christmas music, and I was so bummed about that. I thought, okay, you got this Facebook page, which I really wasn't doing much with. So, and I'm going to do it again in December. Start December 1st, every night before I went to bed, I would post a Christmas song. Mm-hmm. I'd find a great, and I collect pictures. I love photography. I love pictures. So my computer, it started out a hobby on the computer when I went through all those surgeries I did a few years ago. I had cancer and all the back surgery and knee surgery. And it was a really fun time. and I was on so many drugs I couldn't even read, but I could go and search out pictures and make little folders. Mm-hmm. That's why you get a photography.
She sends me pictures every day.
I have a whole list of people that get different. Some people get cats. Some people get kids stuff.
That's like a little gift in your phone. Yeah.
It is.
And yeah, it's just a little thing. It's the way I start the day. It's my way of saying I'm thinking about you. I love you. Have a great day. And and it'd be boring if I wrote that every day, but sending a picture just starts a conversation in your own head. So anyway, I have all these great retro Christmas pictures and stuff. So I would pick the right picture. Like, for example, when they were separating the children from their parents down on the border, I said, remember that Jesus, the baby Jesus, was a refugee and the parents were trying to find a place to stay. And, you know, and so then I got a Pete Seeger song about a very beautiful acoustic song about the birth of the baby Jesus, how cold it was and all that. And then I was looking for the right picture and I found a picture of a Northwest Side Chicago bungalow that had the fence, the wrought iron fence, not the wrought iron fence, the, what do you call this? The metal fences that just were in front of all this and the bad siding. It was really kind of
aluminum fence. Yeah.
Yeah, and the siding on the house and chain link fence. That's what chain link. Yeah. And then they had the big from Menards, the big light up Jesus, Mary, Joseph, and a couple shepherds and the baby Jesus. And they had them all lit up. And then right looking over Joseph's shoulder, two steps up, is a 3 foot, almost said Elvis, but close, Santa. Santa Claus looking down on the manger. And it had snowed and it was a dirty snow. It had been on there for like a week and a half. And it was really just Chicago. kind of a sad, but such a Chicago picture. Yeah, so I put that on.
Perfect.
And it was just like, I felt like, okay, I'll write a little reflection or tell a story. And then they've got the song and then they've got this visual art. And it's a great package. So when I did that last Christmas season and people are like, oh, don't stop. Keep doing this the rest of
do it 365 days a year.
Yeah. So
it's a lot of work.
But then I thought, and this project has turned out to be a lot of work and I'm not making any money, of course, from it. But and also the good news is we are about to transfer all of it onto the internet for people that aren't on Facebook.
Excellent.
I've got a domain called Terry Radio, and we're going to have one with a search engine so you can look up Wilson Pickett.
Oh, that's brilliant, Terry. Get it unzuckerfied. Excellent.
And plus, I'll still do it on Facebook and then transform. But so now in January, and this is before we knew about COVID, in January, I said, everybody's been wanting me to continue this. So tell you what, I'm going to take 2 weeks off and then I'll start. And for those of you that want me to teach a class or tell my life story, I'll do that with music. So there's a purpose for me telling a story.
Brilliant. Right? And Harry, so I love that.
Every day, and I've only missed two nights. And one was I had so many margaritas from Las Fuentes and they were extra strong. She knows what I'm talking about.
Yes.
And I passed out. And then one time after a really, a 3-hour lecture with a mask on, with people all spread out down at Columbia. And I came home, put my laptop on, just writing. And I fell sound asleep. And I woke up. It was 8 o'clock in the morning. I went, oh, wow. So I wrote it then. But I've been really good about even, there have been three nights that I got to leave my house to go to New Buffalo and that was it. That's my vacation for the year. And I brought my laptop and did it there. But I've got this, my whole project here is, okay, you want some life stories? Cause I've got some good stories even before I was in the radio. I mean, my childhood is, just my stand-up comedy routines I used to do about the nuns, and people thought, you're so clever. I go, I'm not making this up. Honest to God.
It actually happened.
I did have a nun, Sister Mary Alcantara, that we called Sister Mary Alcatraz, and it was a working prison at the time. I mean, these sisters of mercy. And I said, they don't know the meaning of the word. I used to say that all the time when I was a kid. These sisters of mercy, they beat the crap out of us. They don't know the meaning of the word mercy. What are you, So anyway, I just thought, well, here's my platform, because if I talked about that on the air, the bosses would come in, throwing stuff at me. And right. so this is a way I can tell story. And sometimes they're just funny. Sometimes they're just music history. Sometimes it's very poignant. And especially this year, timing couldn't have been better.
Oh, wow.
Timing couldn't have been better. Because it helps me just try to dig out something that can be helpful. And people, and I post pretty late at night because that's what I write best. And my cat on my lap and my laptop, and it's great. It makes me focus. And if I haven't accomplished one thing that day, at least I go out of the day thinking, well, you did that.
And people, there's your artistic pivot right there.
Okay,
I mean, you went from being on the air to doing this, and it's just doing something for you and doing something for other people.
Well, and the music education aspect of it, first one I did, and I started with Louis Armstrong because that's where my class starts. I thought, I want to look up and learn something new about Louis Armstrong before I do this. Not just fact check myself, make sure I've got my facts right. And I have discovered so much stuff in that exercise. And then some of them are very personal, and some of them, you know, and writing has been a real, I've never written consistently and so focused in my life. And I'm really enjoying that. It's a lot of work, but I'm really enjoying
different expression.
It's great though.
The other day I wrote about Liz Phair.
I was just going to say, I just read it for the second time. It was so good. I hadn't thought about it in a long time.
I wanted to talk about the 90s and how cool it was in Chicago. All these great Chicago bands.
Polyester Bride.
Yeah. And
Smashing Pumpkins.
Yeah, Smashing Pumpkins, I mentioned, Material Issue, Urge Overkill. Issue. It was great. Mm-hmm. And I said it was great playing on the radio, all these local bands on the radio. Well, Material Issue, you know, Jim, the lead singer, I flunked him. He was my student at Columbia, and I flunked him.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know it either until I was getting ready to MC for them at the Patrol Music Show.
Hey, Jim.
And I knew who Jim was. He was this rock star. And he goes, I took your class at Columbia College. I said, really? I don't remember you. Probably because he didn't show up. And he goes, yeah, you flunked me. And I was just right before I was going out to
MC. And then you just say, you're welcome.
Should have done better.
I said,
what can I tell you?
I said, you flunked yourself. I didn't
flunk
you.
You
flunked it. And I said, and I was right. You didn't make it in radio, did you? And he laughed. And that was sweet. That was sweet. So anyway, but, and then somebody, when I mentioned Material Issues, I get tons of comments. I love the comments. It's a real dialogue, and people are adding their memories and posting pictures of their dad on Veterans Day, you know, and all this stuff. And somebody wrote and said, I was pulling up to go to Jim's wake, and I saw you outside talking to somebody, and I was hoping I'd get to meet you, and by the time I parked the car, you were gone. But that's a memory they took with them that, you know, that was years ago. So people are connecting that way. But with that, I start writing about the Polyester Bride, and I went to look at the video, which I hadn't looked at in decades, and there's all these little film clips of sperm floating around trying to, you know, find its destiny.
It's a really great post.
And it reminded me of going to the YWCA in Piqua for sex education classes and how horrible they were, and I didn't know anything. I was so naive, and I thought you had to swim up the Miami River to get pregnant, you know, this little fish swimming up the stream. Where are they going? How does that make a baby? All I knew was that if you were pregnant and in junior high, your name was never spoken again. You were a social outcast. I don't know what ever happened to those girls. I remember one time I mentioned one. I said, oh, I really miss her. I wonder how she's doing. And they looked at me like, you just did a faux pas, you know.
Like you said Voldemort.
Or yeah. Like Macbeth at the theater. Right. Naming someone almost.
Right. Jeez. And so my mom told me, because I went to this and Dr. Gallagher was there. Somebody remembered his name and added, says, I went to those sex classes too. They were awful. And when I tell these stories, I know that they're relatable to people who've never been to Piqua. You know, it's just, you know, and I'm putting it out there and sort of inviting people to trigger memories about themselves and finding out about the facts of life. But the story was, briefly, is that we had a calendar. We're supposed to mark when our menstrual cycle started. And I would very religiously write it in there. And then I was coming up to the next month, and I go, oh, my period's going to start tomorrow. Well, it didn't. And then the next day, it didn't. And the third day, I'm starting to freak out like something's wrong. it's my period was supposed to start on Tuesday. And it's, you know, so I went to my mom, trying to be really quiet because I have two brothers who would find out information like that and would spread around school. And I said, Mom, I'm late. And she goes, late? Yeah, what? I'm late. You know, like, late, you know. She goes, your library book? No. Your term paper? No. I said, my period. And she laughed. As she's cooking dinner, she laughed and said, oh, maybe you're pregnant. Well, and I didn't know how you got pregnant. I just remember the sperm, you know, you know, those little fish swimming.
And you were a virgin at this point also.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Again, because of the confusion.
What was the point of sex education if you came away from it with this much knowledge?
What were they doing at the YWCA?
What were they teaching you?
The YWCA. They were all embarrassed. They adults hated it. I said in the piece that I was writing, I said, I know they went home and opened up their home bar and had like three drinks or something. I mean, nobody wanted to be there. It was awful. It was just awful. Everybody's uncomfortable, and we didn't learn anything. And
actually negative things, fake news.
Fake news. Like you wrote that you thought that the period was like a train schedule that it came at the same time. I love that.
You're supposed to be.
Always think of that now.
Yeah, and so I was shocked that it hadn't happened. So here, my mom tells me maybe you're pregnant, and I think, okay, I knew with my Catholic inferiority complex and guilt, I knew that I wasn't really a good person, that if people really knew me, they'd hate me, you know, because I was bullied. So I started believing the bullying, which is very common. And so anyway, I went to choir practice with Mom. I was still too young to be in the choir, but I loved going to choir practice. And I'd act like I was doing my homework, but I was really focusing on the dynamics of what was going on in the music, and it was great. But I looked at these people, and they were so sweet, and I thought, they're going to hate me when they find out I'm pregnant. Aww. They will never want to speak to me again. I was just so depressed. And on the way home, Mom's driving the plumbing truck, and the garage is so narrow that the rule was you weren't allowed to talk to her when she was parking the truck because she
had to focus.
So half the way in, I couldn't help myself. This is like out of a movie, but it really happened this way. I broke into tears, just sobbing. Am I really pregnant? And my mom said, hold that thought. Something to that effect. Let me park the truck. And she said, you're not going to leave this truck without knowing everything. And she told me everything I ever learned then for the rest of my life. She did. And then I said something about my dad could have just taken my brothers down the shop. And what I didn't say was you take the male and the female pipes and screw. You know, I left the screw out. But
best place to learn sex ed is in a plumbing truck. Like, well, you see,
the symmetry.
The vulva reaches into box of fittings. It's kind of like this.
Yeah. So that's what I'm doing on Facebook, because I'm writing stuff that triggers people's memories. For Easter came around, and are you frozen, Caitlin?
Am I?
Okay.
No,
okay.
It's just eyes just got very big, and I'm flailing.
Yeah.
So.
So,
I was
listening
to Kathleen snort. It was giving me much joy.
But when Easter came around, I dipped into my stuff of, you know, all the church music I've known. I said, I'm not proselytizing, but it is Good Friday. And this is what I didn't tell. Okay, this is why I won't write a book. Because when one of my bosses, who is of the Jewish persuasion, he would write down all the concerts we were supposed to volunteer to MC. And there might be like 30 concerts for that month. And you're supposed to put 1 through 30, your availability and interest. And you couldn't put not available, because if you did, you'd have to say why you weren't available, because your time was not your own. See, this is why I don't want to write a book. You'll never read this on Facebook.
That's unhealthy as a PS.
Yeah, well,
generally speaking.
And one spring he put out this, there were like 30 some, and like there were probably 15 concerts for Holy Week, like Thursday through Sunday. And that's when I was in choir. I was at church Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. My parents would never come visit me for Easter because they didn't want to go to church every day. And they were very religious. But they'd go, no, we want to go out and have dinner and see Chicago. We don't want to go to church every day. So anyway, And that was my favorite weekend. I just loved it so much. And so there were like 15 concerts. So I just put a big bracket and I wrote Holy Week. And I turned it in. And then he calls me and he goes, "What's Holy Week?" And I said, "That's when we commemorate when you guys killed Jesus." Oh, okay. Okay, you don't have to see.
Bam.
You don't actually believe that part, but you needed to get, let's call him Storm, off your back.
Yes, okay. No, I was just playing with him because, you know, because I knew he wouldn't have a comeback to that because he was smart like enough to. And what was it? So I didn't have to MC that weekend. But I don't want to write a book and write stuff like that, you know.
No, I get it.
Yeah. So
you're writing your stories your own way, which I love.
And I think the format is perfect in little clips with images and music attached.
And there's always a song attached. Sometimes it's nothing to do with my life. Sometimes it's just who T-Bone Walker is and why he was important and who he influenced. And here's, you know, and I have different themes, like Sunday is a song or an artist that influenced the Beatles. And that's been fun. And it's not just your, like, it was obvious Sunday, Chuck Berry, you know, of course. But then other times I've had, like, you know, the theme to The Third Man, the movie, you know, on Zither, how that influenced the Beatles and cheesy lounge music, you know, and stuff like that. And I've had fun doing those and classical music too, especially so, because a little bit of information's, you know, dangerous because I could go on and on all that.
Are you going to do the Christmas one?
Yes.
Christmas series again?
Yes.
Looking forward to that. I'm going to follow you immediately.
After Thanksgiving, I'm going to say now, you know, we're going to, from December 1st to New Year's Eve, we're going to, you know, do a song. Old and new, all different genres, everything.
So like an audio advent calendar.
Thank you.
Auntie Terry's audio advent calendar.
That is
calendar.
Good. They have Lego advent calendars. I've been buying that for my niece and nephew every year. They like that. And at Costco, they had a wine advent calendar that I almost bought for myself. And then I went back to get it and they were sold out. Anyway,
Was it full-size wine bottles?
No.
Was it full-size wine or was it small ones?
Smaller just, wine.
Yeah, like a wine shot.
Like a half a bottle, yeah. No, but like I don't want to be locked into a theme every single day with this. I want to have some wild cards. But I have like Monday as an artist we study in my class, and I kind of go chronologically through two semesters, then start all over again. Wednesday is classical music. Thursday is cover version, so I'll play the original and then the cover and discuss
it. I love that.
And then I started, you know, because I'm Aunt Terry to a lot of kids, and I love children's music. I used to make a series of CDs, but nobody plays CDs anymore, so I quit making them. But I used to have a Christmas. I had a Christmas tape that was up to 176 volumes of Terry Tunes Christmas. But Aunt Terry Tunes.
Gotta take all that Terry Tunes and put it on Spotify.
Spotify
playlist. People love that stuff.
Yeah.
I know people that don't even listen to music, that they just find a Spotify playlist from someone they like Barack Obama is a good one.
Yeah.
And that's all they listen to is that. So you could be that for people.
Well, people have actually said they're making a Spotify list from these things.
I mean,
that's so they can do that. So, with kids, I love kids music. And so now on the weekends, because to me, kids are having a really rough time with this COVID thing. And this gives them something to look forward to. And like this last week, I was Harry Belafonte doing the Banana Boat song with the Muppets.
And, jolly, love that.
And,
jolly, that's exactly the word.
There's animated stuff, and there's all kinds of real variety of stuff. So,
yay.
Futurama's version of Yellow Submarine, you know.
Nice.
Yes. So, you know, and it's really cool. And people are writing and saying that's how they start their morning. They make their cup of coffee and they sit down and they read that. And then sometimes they cry. But what I was going to tell you, like Holy Week, I decided to just put it out there. I said, okay, you know, I'm Catholic, you know, I've been in the church choir, and I'm not proselytizing, but I just want to share with you where I'm coming from on this and how music is such a big part of it. And this is the big season. This is bigger than Christmas. You know, everybody thinks Christmas is a big one, but without Easter, you wouldn't have Christmas. So anyway, theology on tap, you know? Yeah.
Now you know.
Yeah. So, and each day I did, and it's about how you go through the death to get to the resurrection. You don't have the resurrection without the death. And the death is a time that you come in contact with your own losses, your own mourning, personal mourning. And I always felt like when I was a child and still as a senior citizen, on Good Friday, I feel like I'm going to Jesus's wake. And I really feel this grieving. And I used to be, they used to have a 6-foot tall wooden cross at St. Clement's. And this one guy and I don't even know his name. Didn't know his name then either, but we saw each other every Good Friday for like 10 years. And we would carry the cross down in the ceremony and then put it in the stand. And then there'd be two acolytes with the candles on either side. And he and I would hold up the cross, one on each side. And people would come up and do something with the cross. Like they would touch it, they would kiss it, they would embrace it, they would kneel to it, or they just stand there and look at it. Mm-hmm. And we were the only people in the whole church who could see their faces.
Oh, wow.
And that was one of the processes I went through that really, really solidified my faith within organized religion, that this was where they brought their pain. And the more every year I know more and more of these people and personally and what they'd gone through, and I knew what they were bringing to the cross. And there was just something, some energy. And this man and I, we didn't know each other at all, but every time we'd see each other, bump into each other once or twice a year, and we would hug, and it was like this really deep connection, because we knew that we got to, we were privileged to see with our eyes, you know. We didn't have to stick our fingers in a wound or anything. We saw how essential this is to people, how this is what's getting them through the hell that life can be sometimes. And so then by Easter, you know, and I go through all this with music for each one. And then Passover came up, and I said, wow, we are all living Passover. Because we are all huddled with our families in our homes with blood over the doors.
Hoping the plague will pass by the house.
Hoping the angel of death passes us by. And I said, we are all celebrating the
year
Passover,
right?
And I said, and those of us that are Christian that really missed all of our Easter traditions, we feel your pain. So then, and I got tons, Marcy Castor, whose mother was my Jewish mother in Piccolo right up to the day she died. Very precious woman to me. And last time I saw her was at my mother's wake, because she was always there for me. I would take her out to Red Lobster. That was her big deal. You know, she loved Red Lobster.
Jewish mom at Red Lobster.
She was great. And she helped me through some rough stuff, like with all my health issues. She was with me once when I got really bad news. And I left the room because I didn't want anybody to see me cry. And she followed me. And I thought she was going to say, oh, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. Because I was told I might not get to go to college in the fall. And I just graduated, had my tonsils out and got heart trouble from it, you know. And nobody wants to at 18 hear that they might not get to go to college in the fall. And I just didn't want to go through all that crap. So I left the room because her daughter was my roommate. She was having her appendix out. But Mrs. Castor followed me down, and I thought, oh, I don't even want to talk to anybody. And she put her arm around me and said, that was really rough. And it was the first time an adult had ever said anything to me that was true like that.
Wow.
And
validated your feelings.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to be stuck there, but I just wanted to acknowledge and then move on.
Right.
Because then the healing begins. And that's why I connect with kids so much, because I was bullied. So I know how that feels. I can say something to them that's not going to be some stupid adult thing. And, you know, but anyway, so I'm hearing from all these people, Jewish people saying, oh my God, this was beautiful. Thank you very much. And I enjoyed your thing on Easter. I learned so much. And you really got it. Yeah, this is Passover for all this. And then Ramadan came up. And I thought, how lucky do you feel, Hebert? You're going to take this on. And as fascinated as I am by theology, I don't dare say I know a whole lot about Muslim theology. I do remember after 9/11, we had some meetings at St. Clement's about how do we respond to this as a parish. And there was talk about we really need to reach out and be even more ecumenical than we've been, especially like with our Jewish brothers and sisters. I said, well, what about our Muslim brothers and sisters? We got a lot to learn there. And they said, oh, yeah. And so we started doing stuff, you know. And But Ramadan came around, and I thought, okay, now you, this is getting kind of nervy. But I, so I told.
How did I miss this?
I told two stories about two cab drivers, one in New Orleans and one in Chicago, and they were both Muslim. And I told my stories about my interactions with them. Mm. And I said, now our brothers and sisters of the Muslim faith are facing the same dilemma Christians faced in Easter, our Jewish brothers and sisters faced Passover, is all of these going to, you know, to pray together and, mm-hmm. and all these traditions, the family is really is an important time for Ramadan. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, we feel your pain. This is really hard. This is when it's really, really, really hard. And we just have to look forward to when we can all be together again. But those two stories I told about the cab drivers, one of them, I know, Kathleen, you'll love this after the 9/11 thing, but it was like when planes were first starting to fly again after 9/11. Mm-hmm. I was flying somewhere from Midway, and we were out of Belmont and Cicero, so the cab just shot down Cicero, which is a hell of a long drive. But that's
a very long way across the city, but there it is,
and that got me to Midway. Well, I went out with my suitcases. He loaded the car, and before we got to Cicero, you know, we're two blocks from Cicero, before we got to Cicero, I said, are you Muslim? And he said, yes. And I said, how are you doing with 9/11? Are you okay? Mm-hmm. I mean, are people giving you a hard time or, you know, and he said, and he started telling me stuff. And it was like, bingo. As soon as I got in the car, I wanted to hear what he was going through and you know, and let him know that somebody cared, you know, that not everybody thought every Muslim person was a terrorist. Right. Good God. By the time we got to Midway, we got out of the car and he got my suitcase out. And we stood there and looked at each other, and then we hugged.
Oh, wow.
And I said, shalom, my brother. And he said, shalom, my sister. And I started crying. He started crying. It was just, it was like something I'll never forget. And the other one was in New Orleans. This is before 9/11. And, you know, I go down for Jazz Fest every year. Mm-hmm. And I got my cab all ready to go to the airport. And we load up the car, and I said, can you wait just 1 minute? I'm really thirsty. There's a vending machine. I want to get a 7-Up or something. Can you just wait for one? He said, sure, go ahead. I said, do you want something? Can I get you something? He said, oh no, it's Ramadan. Mm. And he was fasting. So when I got in the car being curious, I said, what's Ramadan? Why can't you have something to drink? And he told me, I said, oh, well, that's fascinating. Cause we fast and stuff during Lent, you know, and mom would make stewed prunes for dinner on Good Friday, you know, and it was horrible. And that was really bad. and then we started talking about the similarities between being Catholic and being Muslim. And we had a wonderful talk all the way out to the airport. I said, so there, that's what I know. And, you know, and plus I was in Istanbul and I went to the Blue Mosque, which was the most.
Isn't that beautiful?
That hit me more than the Vatican did. I mean, yeah, I felt like it was a real spiritual place.
Yeah.
The Vatican, I felt money, power, and poison
it's
rings.
Dark, too.
Remember? Right. Yeah, poison rings. except though, our choir sang for the Pope a few times, and because there's a choir tour of Italy, and I had to go to the bathroom. So I went, and on the way out, you know, you see those pictures of the light coming through the windows. And I saw one of those lights, and I stood there, and I just went, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, because you see pictures of it. And that was
when
cool.
Those light comes through those windows that are at the top of the dome.
Yeah.
Right.
Because it's a very dark space.
Yes. But boy, it's
amazing.
But
that, the play of light in that place is like.
Oh, it's amazing. And singing at the Vatican. Although one thing that happened that really upset me was we were singing and it was kind of warmish. It was October. It was like 70s, beautiful day. And the Pope was out there, not the good one, the other one. And he was out
the German.
There.
The German.
No, even before the German. Oh, yeah. Oh. The Polish one.
The Polish one.
Yeah.
Right.
And he's out there giving the mass and all these bishops are in green vestments.
Season is that.
The big hat, you know, the big, yeah. And Wicked Witch of the, anyway. But
the mitre, the bishop's mitre.
Yes, the mitre, yeah. Mightier than the sword. And they're all standing there. And we're one of three choirs. There's a choir from Spain, a choir, the Vatican choir, which were awful because they were all soloists and there was no blending. My mother would have just been furious. Everybody wanted to be heard. You can't do that in choir. And so we were watching and all of a sudden this one bishop keels over, just flat out. Doesn't look like a faint. Wasn't one of those like kind of
lucky. Was he smited?
It could have been a heart attack or a stroke or we don't know. But it didn't look like a faint. It wasn't one of those that looked wobbly and then, you know. And we were probably like 50 yards away. And not one of those bishops, his brothers, not one of them attended to him. They had their eyes on the Pope. And this guy laid there for till they finally got somebody with a stretcher and ran up, put him on the stretcher. And I almost
said, much for humanity.
I almost did like the when Jesus flipped out and threw the money lenders
flipping
out.
Tables.
Get the hell out of here. Yeah. What are you this is my father's house. Get your crap out of here.
All right.
I was furious. And I thought, if that was Jesus up there, he would have called a timeout and attended to that guy.
Flag on the plate. Right.
Yeah. And he would have knelt at that guy. And if he was dying, he would have, you know, not even bring him back to life, but to be with him.
Comforted him. Right. Yes, been with him while
he would have been present.
Right.
And present is really important. And those bishops, not a one of them flinched. And that made me mad the rest of the week. But the funny thing is, so the next day we were at a gelato stand.
I was like, please tell me you're at a gelato stand.
Yeah, because it's like Starbucks, you know? I mean, there's one on every corner. And these two people came up and they went, are you Terry Hemmert? And I said, yeah. And they go, oh my God. Yeah. I said, oh, hi, how you doing? And my friends are going, we can't go anywhere. And then they said, were you singing at the Vatican yesterday? And I said, yeah, because we sang three different times. And one time it was just for a mass inside. It wasn't a big to-do. Mm. And they were at the mass. And they said, that woman in that choir looks like just like Terry Hemmert. Could be her twin sister, you know.
Oh, my gosh.
It could be. But what are the odds of them bumping into me at a gelato stand the next day?
In your life, I would say pretty good, probably.
Seriously.
I did meet a listener in Istanbul once, and I'm walking up to him, and he goes, Aunt Terry in Istanbul.
That's what
of course you are.
He lived there. He was Turkish. He lived in Geneva for
That's so amazing.
And my mom had the credit card out. And he goes, oh, where are you from? Ohio. But our daughter's here from Chicago. And he said, oh, I live around Chicago. And oh, what radio station? XRT. Look at my credit card. And it's Betty Hemmert. And he went, are you Terry Hemmert's mother?
Wow.
So she said, well, if you want to meet her, she's meeting us at the front gates. Because I didn't want to go to the bazaar and shop and stuff. I wanted to just walk around Istanbul by myself. And I had a great day. I mean, I met all these people and just talked to them. And it was wonderful. And you can only do that when you're by yourself. That's true. I go to New Orleans. I'm always go off by myself once in a while. And that's how I meet locals. That's great.
That's easy to do in New Orleans, too, though.
Yeah.
And you can hear their stories. Yeah. Like, but if you have a whole group of people, they aren't going to approach you.
No, you won't be approached.
You're
not available. Caitlin and I are not group traveler types at all.
No.
I go either way.
Except for work when, you know, you have to.
Well, yeah. When you're like traveling with the circus, literally.
Well, you know, I went with a bunch of senior citizens before I was one myself. Old St. Pat's group. And they went around the Alps. We drank our way around the Alps, I swear to God. And then we only had one mass. They said, this is a Catholic tour. Aren't we supposed to have a mass ever so often? And I'm like,
bless the
beer,
you're fine.
Yeah. And they were like,
they had one mass and everybody's going, you and your big mouth. And then the priest said, would you like to be my server since it was your big mouth that got us into this? I said,
off the bench. Wine drinking. Off the bench. Did you use the Latin though? That's my question.
No,
did you?
I already served at St. Clement, so I knew what I was doing. But he's still the pastor at Old St. Pat's. And remember they had those
Jack?
No, the predecessor.
Oh, okay.
I'm spacing on his name now. It's a long time ago and that we drank a lot. But anyway, we were on stage.
Cusick! The other one. Yeah.
No, yeah.
The one who doesn't like me. Never mind.
Tom, I think. Really nice guy. Mm-hmm. And and anyway, we were on stage at the world's largest office party. The issue for this big street party to raise money for the church.
Yep.
Way to do it. And everybody go out and get drunk like crazy. And we were on stage together and we had our arms around each other. I said, this priest, this father, he's really cool. We drank our way around the Alps, you know. But we had a great time. We had an extraordinary time. And I'm starting to wonder because every time I do one of those group things at the end when the guide gets up and thanks you, they always say, this has been the most unique group I've ever had. I'm starting to get a complex about it. But like when we went with that group, and the last, our guide was Sue. And so I wrote the different words to Peggy Sue, the Buddy Holly song. And the hotel was so nice, they ran off copies for me. And at 3 a.m, when, you know, they take you out in the middle of the night and take you to the airport. And I got up to conduct everybody's, if you knew our guide Sue, you would like love her like we do. And then have these little jokes. And she said, sit down. It's against the law for you to stand on this bus while it's moving. I'm sorry. But we've had a great time.
Indeed.
Yeah, I like traveling with people. I miss traveling.
You're so preaching to the choir in this Zoom room.
The choir's back. There you go.
So how are we doing on time? Should we? Okay. So we.
I don't have anywhere to go.
Sometimes do. We.
True. I mean,
it's Tuesday in Chicago. Nothing to do.
Same. I'm curious because you love to travel and you love to see live music, and we've all said, like, when this is over, the first thing where would you want to go and who would you want to hear live?
The New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
Yeah,
that really hurt this year. I missed that. I've been going every year for over 30 years. And that's my happy place. I have old friends down there. I meet new friends every time. I bump into a lot of listeners because they go down there.
Right.
And I love the music and I love the musicians. I know a lot of them, and it's my second home. It's my spiritual home. And I always go to mass at the cathedral, because one year I heard the priest say, welcome if you're here for the Jazz Fest, and we want to be your Jazz Fest parish. So that's my jazz. Actually, there was one time too that was, I'll never forget, that I went to mass and they had a memorial mass for all the first responders that died that year. And so their families were there and guys in uniform, and it was really emotional. And at the end of mass, they invited all of us to join, if we could, a procession. They were going to have a service, a little ceremony on the river, Mississippi River. And you walk through Jackson Park and then up the bank and
picture.
And it's just beautiful. And it was something, and I told this story in one of my Facebook things, and people were just crying. But I remember they had this, the cardinal at the time, and I was by myself, because everybody says, oh, I want to go to mass with you. Yeah. And every year they go, oh, I'm pretty tired.
Really
I was up till 3 a.m. I said, okay. So I go by myself. And anyway, they had the Marine Corps band playing and a guy playing bagpipes, which always makes me cry.
Oh, geez.
And then they had a boat in the Mississippi River that was, you know, like a fireboat, was spraying water. And they threw two gigantic wreaths of flowers into the river, one for the firefighters and one for the police, and watched it float down. And the cardinal got up there and said, now the band is going to play Amazing Grace and we're all going to sing along. And if you think, oh, but I can't sing, well, that's the voice God gave you, so sing. And everybody sang. Everybody sang. I will never forget that moment. And that was my mom's theory. Everybody can sing. Yep. Every choir concert she had, there was a lyric sheet on your seat that you had to pick up before you sat down. And at the end of the concert, everybody had to sing along. I mean, and she said, I don't care if you can't sing, you know.
Not the point.
Flat. That's right. Yeah, not the point. And she invited people to share that. Right. And that's what that cardinal did that day. And those, everybody, and a lot of them from mass, but a lot of tourists thinking, oh, what's this? And then joining, because it was a real Catholic, the altar boys were in those Cossacks that I always wanted to wear, you know, oh God. And I got to wear an alb a few times, and that was very exciting. In fact, when I put it on one day, I said, does this mean I have to take a vow of chastity? And they said, yes. And I pulled it off. But the priests I know are really funny. They're great. But that to me is what it's all about, is that that's the voice God gave you, so sing.
Yeah.
And my mom did that. She had people there were two people from the Dayton Opera Chorus that would drive 25 miles each way to go sing with this community chorus. There were bankers, farmers, black and white, high school kids, senior citizens, people that were brilliant singers, people that could barely get up. You know, you kind of put them in the back row. But mom never discouraged them. And she told me something that really stuck with me once. She said in her church choir, she had an alto, this old woman who was just awful. Just couldn't get it. And mom didn't want to kick her out of the choir. So mom called her aside and she goes, I need your help. Could you help me? She goes, oh, Betty, anything. What do you need me to do? She goes, I have too many altos and they're drowning out the rest of the choir. And I don't want to tell people any altos that they couldn't be in the choir anymore. But if I could get you guys just to sing softer, then it wouldn't. You know, so mom said she never heard her sing again. She never heard her voice come, you know, because people that can't sing usually want to sing loud.
Yeah.
And the woman didn't have to leave the choir.
Right.
She didn't get embarrassed. My mom didn't call her out and say, you can't sing, you know, get out of here. None of that crap, which I've seen other choir directors do. And that woman got to sing every Sunday. And that's what it's about.
Yeah.
That's what it's about.
That's exactly what it's about right there.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I like it when Facebook people, when they participate, and they'll write back.
That's your choir.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Everybody's, you know.
Yeah. And I'm their ombudsman.
It's the call and response.
Conductor. And like Veterans Day was just the other day, and I always do something about my dad. Put a picture of him when he's in the Air Force. Somebody put a picture of their dad when in the Navy in World War II. And Mother's Day, I invited people to put pictures of their mothers and they told stories and it was just beautiful. Mm. It was just beautiful, you know, and Facebook is so abused, but it's a potentially a wonderful way to communicate.
It is.
Because it's the two way. It's not, if I wrote a book, I would never hear from people, you know, but every day, and this feeds me
more immediate.
And it's not, yeah, and it's not like, ooh, they love me or they read my stuff, you know. It's not about that. It's about how they feel connected. And I think this is good use of my time because it helps me, it helps them. And my cat likes to be on my lap when I'm on the laptop.
What's the kitty's name? I've forgotten.
Penny Lane. And Penny I didn't come up with that name, though. My friend that rescued her came up with that.
That's
fantastic.
Because my other was it. My other She's was a Band-Aid. Irma. Well, the other was Irma after Irma Thomas.
Yeah.
Irma Thomas, the Soul Queen of New Orleans. And my grandmother, Hemmert, was Irma.
Really?
Nice. Yeah. And I just thought, you
Penny
know.
Lane.
To
oh, Penny Band-Aid. Lane. I love that.
Yeah.
She's a Band-Aid.
She's
Man,
a sweetheart.
Man, Terry, your ministry of sound just continues on and on and on. I'm so glad for it. I'm so glad for you.
Yeah.
Thank God that your creative energy is just unstoppable that you're doing this.
You know, it's really it's got me out of the house. Well, I made it and I made it way beyond I ever anticipated. My dream was to be a top 40 DJ, which means I would have been out of work by 30 because, you know, you didn't have anybody in their 30s.
Not a thing anymore.
I'm 72 and I still have college kids that want to listen to me for 3 hours.
Absolutely. You know,
I love that. And going to, like, I used to go to a lot of schools. Anybody asked me and I'd go. And I went to this one school and we talked about John Lennon. And then I said, you know what John Lennon would want you to do? What? He'd like you to do something for the homeless. So these kids on their own put together this whole thing. They did a toy drive and a coat drive for the homeless. And they asked me to come back and pick up all the stuff. So I spent another day with them and they loaded my car. And I said, John Lennon would be so proud of me. And I wanted to give them something. And so I remembered in my basement, I look like a hoarder. And my neighbor once said, it's not, you're not a hoarder. It's just your life is bigger than your home. I said, thank you. I feel so much better. And
that
I feel so neurotic.
Fantastic.
That's beautiful. It is. Because people come and say, well, let's go through these bins. We'll help you. And they'll, this woman once opened up, pulled out and said, oh, wow, what's this? And then, oh, you can't throw this away. I go, I know.
Precisely, yes.
So anyway, somebody had done this big, I mean, it's like this big, huge, chalk picture of John Lennon. It was beautiful, but I had no place to hang that. And I'd have to get a frame for it. And it was just, you know, it was just like, but I didn't want to throw it out. I mean, somebody really worked hard. So I'd always look at it when I do my laundry and be leaning against something. And so I dug that out And I gave it to the class. And when I said, I want to give you a gift, and this is some woman did this after John died and mm-hmm. sent it to me, and I turned it around and they gasped. They were like, oh, they were, the kids were almost crying. It was so, such a beautiful moment. And mm-hmm. I said, well, you touched me and I wanted to give you something of mine. And you asked me to come out and get all the stuff for the homeless shelter that I was working with at the time, Lincoln Park Shelter. And I said, I want to give you something. And the teacher was in tears and she said, we're going to get that framed and this will always hang in this room, you know. But it was just amazing. So I have found radio has just given me an opportunity. It's good, you know, I can get into places where they call security otherwise. Could you remove this old lady? And just, you know, going back to that roots of rap thing, I became fearless then. If I could go into a group of inner city black kids, usually boys, it all started at St. Joseph's in Cabrini Green before that was taken over by the Uppies. But I went in there.
That was a rough area.
Yeah.
For the audience who doesn't know Chicago.
And my car got broken into and I walked in, these guys were giving me an attitude and they were laughing anytime I'd start answering a question. And I said, you know what? This is no fun for me. I'm going to leave if you don't show me some respect because you don't even let me get an answer out of my mouth. And if I say something stupid, have at it, you know, go ahead. Mm-hmm. But you're going to miss any kind of pearls of wisdom I could pass on to you. And being a woman in this business, I know something about discrimination. I know how crippling it is and how it stinks. So you might learn something from my experience if you quit laughing at me. And they were like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it went really well. And then I told them, I said, I'm not going to come in here and say, we want it. And they all wanted to be rappers. I said, I'm not going to say, okay, go to college and blah, 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 blah. But I'm going to say it'd be a good idea to go to college because then you can take some sound engineering courses so your music can sound like you hear it, not how somebody else hears it.
There you go.
You should take some history classes and find out, you know, African-American history and all kinds of history courses to find out, you know, what led up to this, why things are the way they are. You should take some business law courses so that, you know,
you can read a contract and not get screwed over by it.
Yes. Yeah. And all this stuff. And I said, this is an education. It's not about the diploma. It's about what you learn. Yeah. And I said, it would serve you well. And then if you don't make it in hip hop, then you're going to have some other interests that you didn't know you had or capabilities of, you know, you thought, I didn't know I'd be so good at that, you know, well, get out there and try some stuff. And, you know, and I told them that I didn't want them just to be any old rapper. I wanted them to be the best they could be. And learning history is part of it, and music history. And I said, you know, that's where I got the idea of teaching them the roots of rap. Because at the end, one of them, and this was 100 years ago, somebody said, well, what do you think about rap now? You know, and they started laughing again, that derisive laugh. And I said, stop it. I said, you hear yourself? Hear how different that is? You weren't laughing with me. You were laughing at me. And you didn't even give me a chance to answer the question. So back off. And I said, okay, there's a lot of rap I don't like because I understand the violence part, you know, you're writing about a reality, but when it's gratuitous, I think it's toxic and perpetuates a problem, and misogyny is not really appealing to me. Other than that, when rap is like street poetry, like Common, this is before Common, but doing this. And
Chicago's own.
I know. But at the time I mentioned Grandmaster Flash, The Message, and they started laughing again. And I said, what's so funny about that? And they said, well, it's a funny name, Grandmaster Flash. And I said, don't you know who Grandmaster Flash is? I said, well, then instead of laughing at me, say,
children, let me tell
who
you
is Grandmaster Flash and why should I care? And then you'd learn something. And that's what I'm talking about. You aren't learning anything because you're busy laughing at people. And it's, and I know it's a reflexive thing, but break that habit because you can learn some shit. You know, so, oops, sorry.
I got no, you're fine. You can swear all you want.
This is so good.
I should have told you that ahead of time.
I stopped myself a couple of times. No,
you don't have to.
I'm a potty mouth. I used to be a merchant marine. I was a merchant marine and I lived in a woman's dorm for 4 years. I can swear.
Wait, yeah. You weren't actually a merchant marine, were you? Mm-hmm. Wait, what? Okay. Beep, 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 beep.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today for this episode. If you'd like to hear more about the artists we talked to today, you can go to our website at artistcareandfeeding.com. You'll find social links for the artists and websites and possibly some video clips. You will also find a tip jar, so please throw some money in there and help feed the artists. And you can follow us on Instagram and Twitter. If you want to drop us a line, please email us at artistcareandfeeding@gmail.com. We would like to thank Martin Hanlon and Eric Escalante for the theme music and Kurt Leitner for our logo art. Thanks so much for listening. Please come back.